Inside the Law is presented to educate listeners in Monmouth and Ocean counties about legal issues. The opinions expressed by the host, guests, and phone callers are strictly their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Town Square Media and are not intended to be a substitute for personal legal advice from your own attorney. Your questions and comments are welcome at 732-364-5830. Inside the Law, talk radio for the Jersey Shore.
Good morning, everyone out there in Monmouth and Ocean counties and to all those elsewhere listening in on the Internet. I'm Doug Hull of the law firm of Novi & Associates. We're the law firm that specializes in elder law, which includes asset protection, Medicaid planning, guardianships, trust and estate planning, administration and litigation. And you're listening live to Inside the Law on 1160 WOBM AM in Ocean County and 1310 AM in Monmouth County and all over the world on WOBMAM.com. You know the format. Each week we take you, the listeners, inside the law to learn about an issue or a topic of interest. Today our topic is dealing with diminished capacity. Today we'll be discussing techniques for protection, the importance of planning, and assistance from governmental programs. Typically on the show, we would have a guest, but today I'm going to be handling this topic myself. Now, should you have any questions about the issues that are being discussed today or any other legal questions, as always, we welcome and encourage you to call in with the questions that you may have. A little bit of a difference today is that we're having a little bit of technical problems with our phone lines. So there are going to be two numbers today that are a little bit different. So I'm going to announce the numbers a couple of times during the show. But the two numbers are 732-281-5970. And the second number is 732-281-5971. So that's 70 and 71. And as I said, I'll mention this a couple of times during the show. So please call in, and our sound engineer, Lauren, will help hopefully get you on the air. As I indicated in the lead-in, today we're going to be talking about dealing with diminished capacity. Now, I'm sure you've heard the phrase that the only two things certain in life are death and taxes. Well, diminished capacity may not be a certainty, but if we live long enough, chances are extremely good that we will either experience this ourselves or we will experience it through others around us. And the question is really not whether, it's a question to what extent. Now, when we deal with this personally, there are a couple of ways that we can address it. One would be denial, and the other would be planning. And as I said, we can either do this personally or for someone else, and that would typically be a family member, whether it's a situation where you are trying to help out mom or dad or Uncle Harry. Or sometimes it's a reversal where we have a parent who once again is being thrust into the situation of handling something for a child who is now an adult but is experiencing diminished capacity issues. Now, when we're talking about diminished capacities for the purposes of today's show, we're really not talking about from a purely physical, standpoint of, whether I can run a marathon anymore, although there are certainly people of somewhat advanced age who still run marathons. But it's more so the mental capacity of handling things. Now, as I indicated, the first way that some people will deal with this issue is through denial, and suffice it to say that that is definitely not the way to go. You know, unfortunately, there have been a number of times where I've spoken to people and, you know, talked about this this issue of planning, and basically their standpoint is, well, this is something that won't happen to me. I've got good genes, or whatever the reasoning is. So they're reluctant to do any planning in this regard. Other times, the people will kind of get into a procrastination mode of saying, well, I don't have the problem today, but if I see in the future that I need it, then I'll do something about it. And, you know, sometimes the reasoning given is I don't want to expend the money for the documentation, or I really haven't decided how I wanted to deal with this. But it's definitely a situation where the ultimate decision is put off. You know, sometimes people will ask, well, you know, do I need this now or will I need it? And my usual explanation is that my crystal ball is not functioning properly, you know, today, but it's certainly something where I would rather be safe than sorry, and that's certainly what we recommend to our clients. The downside of not doing the proper planning is so significant in terms of cost and hardship, both to the person and to their families, that, you know, it really is, in my opinion, a no-brainer that planning is the way to go. Now, assuming that the person has gotten to the stage of saying, I want to plan ahead for what would happen if I should experience diminished capacity, or for that matter, maybe the person is recognizing that there are some signs that this is taking place and want to be proactive. People can plan for both life and death issues, and frankly, more people tend to be willing to plan for what would happen upon their death by, you know, making a will than those who want to plan for what would happen during their lifetime. So if a person is going to try to plan for the will, there is a capacity issue there. In order to make a valid will, a person has to have a certain minimal level of mental competence or capacity. And the standard is pretty much that there be a recognition by the person of what their estate consists of. So what are their assets? You know, what outstanding liabilities do they have, and therefore what is available for distribution? And then they have to know who the, and this is a technical term, who the natural objects of their bounty are. So typically, if you have a widow who has three children, the natural objects of her bounty would be the three children. Now, that is not always the case, that the person wants to leave, you know, his or her estate to the natural objects of their bounty. And therefore, the third part of the equation is that the person must have the ability to decide how they wish to distribute their estate and who they wish to have handle the estate. The person who handles the estate is called the executor. And I'm sure you've heard that term on the show frequently. So the person has to be able to go through that process. Now, that doesn't mean that that the individual has to know that, you know, I have 472 shares of this stock, and it's presently, you know, valued at this exact number, and, you know, I have these bank accounts at this particular institution, and here are the account numbers and the values. The person has to at least have a general recognition of what their estate consists of. Now, I talked about the fact that you may not want to leave your estate to the natural objects of your bounty. Really, the only possible situation in New Jersey where you may be obligated to leave a portion of your estate to a particular person would be the case of a husband and wife. And even then, it's only if the financial circumstances fall into a particular category, which are designed to prevent one comparatively wealthy spouse from effectively impoverishing the other spouse. Short of that, you have no obligation to leave your estate to those who are theoretically nearest and dearest to you. Now, one thing that has to be recognized is that the lower the level of capacity that a person has, the greater the risk that there could be what is known as undue influence. And undue influence typically comes up where you have a situation where there is a confidential relationship between the person making the will and some other individual. The person making the will has a certain degree of dependence on this other person, whether it be financial, emotional, or doing tasks. So there's a dependence there. And the greater the level of possible undue influence, the greater the chance of a will contest. Now, you know, you may have heard, you know, people getting very concerned that somebody's going to contest the will because they don't like it. And that is possible. But the question is not whether a person can contest it. It's whether they can win in a will contest. And, you know, in order to do so, you really have to show one of several, things. And one of those would be a lack of capacity to make the will or the existence of undue influence, which essentially is one person overriding the free will of another as far as making the will. Now, sometimes we run into difficulties as far as scheduling appointments and things because you might have a situation where a person who seeks to make a will would like to have a family member present during the estate planning interview, either to supply some information that is necessary to properly do the will, or sometimes just as a hand-holding situation because they're nervous, meeting with the attorney. The problem with that is that the greater the involvement of this other person, and probably most frequently it's a child, but the greater the involvement, the greater the chance that there could be domination of the child over the parent, and it will bring the possibility into existence of there being a subsequent will contest. As a matter of policy, we try to keep third parties, whether it be a child or whatever, out of the estate planning process, both for the benefit of the person making the will and his or her estate, and also, frankly, for the benefit of the child, so that his or her well-meaning assistance doesn't come back to haunt them by way of a will contest. So those are pretty much the basic ramifications of capacity with regard to making a will. Now, I said I would remind the listeners of today's number. So the phone numbers for today are 732-281-5970 and 281-5971. And again, we welcome your calls. Now, the second document that is to be considered for proper planning is a power of attorney. Now, a power of attorney, by definition, is a document by which one person gives to someone else either specific powers or the power to do everything for that person that he or she could do themselves. It actually, to have a valid power of attorney, it actually is requires a higher standard of capacity than a will does, because now you're talking about giving somebody the power to take actions for you, during your lifetime. It's very upsetting and unfortunate when we have situations where a family will come into the office, indicate that they were talking to somebody at a long-term care facility or something of that nature, and we're told that it would be a very good thing if there was a power of attorney from, let's say, mom to one of the children. And, the first question we'll ask is, well, is mom, willing to do this? And unfortunately, all too often, the response is, well, we have no idea because mom, doesn't have the ability to express herself anymore, or dad just stands there, sits there, staring at the wall. He can't, formulate, any decisions. And unfortunately, at that point, we have to explain, to them that a power of attorney is now, not in the cards, because the person has to have, the sufficient level of understanding of recognizing what a power of attorney is, recognizing that they're giving this power and authority to someone else, and being able to decide to whom they wish to give the power. Now, sometimes people will have a reluctance to sign a power of attorney, either because they think that this is an admission on their part that they are no longer capable of acting for themselves, when in fact it's just it's almost the opposite, that they are making an intelligent decision to plan ahead. And sometimes there's also a reluctance to give the power to a particular person. Sometimes this will result in a situation where a person has us prepare what is sometimes referred to as a springing power. And the reason it's given that term is because it only takes effect upon the person's disability, and at that point it springs into effect. I have two issues with that. One is that from a practical standpoint, there are sometimes problems with determining whether that lack of capacity has occurred, and you may have a difference of opinion between family members or even medical professionals. The second is, if you are concerned about giving this person the power, then I would strongly suggest that you find a different person to name, because you should have the belief that this person is totally trustworthy and would always do do right by you. You may have also heard the term a durable power of attorney. Now, a durable power is not something that's prepared on particularly strong paper. What it means is that if a person subsequently became disabled or incapacitated, that this power of attorney would remain in full force and effect. Powers of attorney can either have both medical and financial powers in it, or you can have separate powers of attorney, one dealing with medical and one dealing with financial. Sometimes people will want to have different people handling the different aspects of their care. People who go through the process of having this documentation prepared will also note that there are typically a number of very specific powers set forth. The reason for that is that there are some companies or types of agencies out there that want to make sure that it was intended by the person to give their agent the power to act in this particular area, and in the absence of a specific listing of that power, they won't honor it. So to deal with that, there will typically be specific powers for getting information from doctors and healthcare providers under the HIPAA laws, for doing banking transactions, for dealing with insurance companies, filing tax returns, and the like. And this is all done in an effort to make sure that the power of attorney will be accepted and recognized. Now, when naming an agent to serve, you can do it in several ways. Sometimes people will name one particular individual to do it. If they're doing that, we will always recommend that an alternate be named because you want to take care of the possibility that something would happen to the person. You can also name multiple people in two different fashions. One would be to have the powers be what is called joint and several, which means that either of the people named can act. Or sometimes people will require that the action be joint, where both people will act. That is sometimes cumbersome, but sometimes people will want it just so that there's a greater degree of oversight. And I believe we have a caller. Liz, good morning. How are you? I'm just fine, thanks. What can we do for you?
Well, I'm kind of freaking out here because I heard what you said earlier, and I have a possible problem here. I'm my aunt's power of attorney.
Okay.
She made the document a couple years ago, and I didn't think much of it. You know, she just doesn't have any children, so I said, sure, I'd be glad to help her out. But she's not doing very well now, and I'm concerned about her living alone. So I went to visit some assisted living facilities, and I brought her with me, and she was like, nah, don't like it. I don't need to be here. I want to live alone. Leave me alone. And I talked to the facilities later. I called them back, and they said that, you know, even with my power of attorney, if my aunt doesn't want to stay there, that they can't keep her there. But I'm getting really worried about her living alone. Am I going to need a guardianship?
Well, I think you kind of you know, raise a couple of issues. One, and I thank you for the question, because one thing to recognize about a power of attorney is that while it gives someone else, in this case your aunt, gave you the power to take action for her, it does not take away her power to continue to act for herself, and that is very important from a comfort standpoint for the person giving the power, but it sometimes creates a situation where, because the person still has the legal ability to act for themselves, they are trying to take action which they may think is good, but the rest of the world may think is not in his or her own, in her own best interest. So sometimes the situation exists where, despite having the power of attorney, which gives you the authority to act, if you try to take action that you, honest to God, feel is in your aunt's best interest, and she undoes that or prevents it, thwarts your efforts to try to help her, sometimes it becomes a question of, well, does she have the mental capacity to make appropriate decisions? If the answer is yes, and the doctors say she's competent, she has the mental capacity to decide, then, for better or for worse, people have the right to make bad decisions. If, on the other hand, the doctors say, no, from a medical standpoint, we don't believe she's competent, then sometimes the only remedy available is to institute a guardianship action so that you could be appointed as her legal guardian. A guardianship action, as opposed to a power of attorney, takes away the person's power to act for themselves and would then give you the power to act for her. If that ever came to that, and I certainly hope it does not, but if it ever came to that, I wouldn't hold out any hope that your aunt would think that you were the best thing since sliced bread.
Well, how do you know when you've reached that point? I mean, she's not taking her medication. She's talking about people in her attic. And, I mean, she's starting to do some really weird things that scare me. And I just I want to make sure she's safe, and that's why we checked out some of these assistant living facilities. But she keeps saying she doesn't need any help. She doesn't need the medications. The doctors don't know what they're talking about. And she's okay with those people in the attic.
Well,
which are not there, by the way.
I would hope not. certainly my recommendation would be to try to speak to the medical providers, medical services providers in her life. If necessary, schedule appointments with them so that input can be received from them. Because as part and parcel of a guardianship action, if it ever came to that, you have to have reports from two licensed physicians, or you're allowed to have one psychologist from the state of New Jersey, advising that in their medical opinion the person is incapacitated. So it's not something where your opinion controls the situation. While the judge makes the ultimate determination, there have to be the two medical reports backing it up.
Would I automatically be made the guardian since I'm her power of attorney?
It gives you a basis for saying that you are the appropriate person, because when she was competent, she indicated that you are the person who she would want to handle the affairs for her. But from a legal standpoint, it would be your obligation in a guardianship action to give notice of the proceeding to her nearest next of kin, and the next of kin have a preference for being appointed, but the judge, it's not binding. The judge could determine that under the facts of a particular case, someone other than the next of kin, should be appointed.
Well, I'm her next of kin, but this is just a question I'm asking because I love my aunt and I want to take good care of her. But what if, for some reason, I could not be her guardian? like if I moved to California or something,
right,
and she's here. What could we do in a situation like that?
Well, I'll cover part of it at this point, and then a little bit later in the show, I'm going to throw out another possibility. But you know, you could look for another family member who is available to do it, or a very close friend who is, you know, trustworthy and is willing to do it. If there are no family members or friends who are ready, willing, and able to step up to the plate, then a possible solution is a state agency, which is called the Office of the Public Guardian. And I'm going to be talking about them a little bit later on in the show.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. You've been very helpful.
Not a problem. I hope things go well with your aunt, and have a wonderful weekend.
Me too. Thank you.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Okay. Bye-bye. I would just like to make one final comment about powers of attorney, and then we're going to take a little break. And that comment is that a person who does a power of attorney has the ability to either revoke that or to amend it in the future. It's not a situation where if you do it once, then you can never undo it. So if you name somebody and then you become dissatisfied with how they're handling things, or you think better of it, you can revoke the document and either name somebody else or modify the terms of it. So we have certainly additional information that I want to be covering, but as I said, we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back with some more information. Thank you. Welcome back, everyone. This is Doug Hull of Novi & Associates, and you're listening to Inside the Law on 1160 WOBM AM in Ocean County and 1310 AM in Monmouth County. And the show is also available on the Internet at WOBMAM.com. Before I get back into the information, I'd like to once again give today's telephone numbers. They're 732-281-5970 and 281-5971. Now, we've been talking about planning for the possibility of incapacity. Two other documents that I want to talk about. One is commonly known as a living will. The living will is sometimes almost used in a generic sense. It is technically a document by which a person expresses general wishes as to whether they would or would not want extraordinary means used to sustain their life in the event that they had a very serious, you know, life or death type illness. And, you know, a living will is pretty much an expression of a person's wishes. There are a couple of other ways of addressing the same issue. One is by having a document called a medical proxy or a medical power of attorney. There, you're basically designating a particular person and to handle your decisions in the event that you're unable to do so yourself. You don't have to give any particular guidance. Another way of addressing it is to have a document which is called an advance directive, and there you give more specific information as far as what you would or would not want done in particular situations. We have a caller, and I don't want them to have to hold, so we'll deal with the caller, and then I have to come back to this issue. Good morning, Carol. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for taking my call.
Our pleasure.
My executor lived close by. Now he moved 1,800 miles away. So I want to change the will. And he insists it's not necessary. It's only a plane ride away. Do you think I should just override his wishes and appoint someone else who lives closer?
Well, you know, who will serve as your executor is certainly your decision. So if from a comfort level you want to make a change, that's certainly up to you. Now, I assume that you're a resident of the state of New Jersey.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Because in some states, it from a legal standpoint, it matters whether the person is a resident of your state.
Oh.
New Jersey, it does not.
I see.
You know, there's no legal requirement that the executor, reside in New Jersey or reside close.
Mm-hmm.
We certainly have situations where the executor lives quite far away.
Oh.
and can nevertheless do the job.
Oh,
there are probably two primary times when the executor's physical presence in New Jersey would be very helpful. Not absolutely necessary, but certainly helpful. As technology has improved, or at least become more technical, there's more ability to do things by phone, on the internet, faxes, emailing, things like that. And it's also possible for the executor to retain the services of an attorney to assist in the estate administration process. Very often that's done even if the executor happens to be local. So I guess my answer to your question is, if the person is who you would want to do it, I don't think that the distance automatically prevents them from doing the job well.
Okay, you don't think it'd be a problem. Now, if he couldn't do it, the other alternate lives much closer.
Okay.
Would the first person have to do that letter of annunciation that he couldn't act as executor so that the alternate person could be the executor?
Yes, if a person names Mary as the executor and John is the alternate,
mm-hmm.
Then if at the time of the person's death Mary is alive, Mary is the one who has the ability to serve. If Mary and John kind of reach an agreement that it would be better for John to do it,
okay.
Then Mary would sign a document called a renunciation.
Right.
They would give that to the surrogate, mm-hmm. and then the surrogate would have the ability to appoint John.
Now, where would they get this letter of
renunciation? Again, it can either be obtained from the surrogate's court, or if they have an attorney representing them, the elder law attorney would typically be able to give them a form.
Oh, so that's a form letter? Is that it?
It's there's particular language that's supposed to be in it.
Well, thank you so much for your help.
You're quite welcome.
You've solved many problems. Thank you so
Great.
Much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye. As I said, I just wanted to make one other comment with regard to the category of the Living Will Advanced Directive, and that is that we have found that the best way of addressing it is to have kind of a hybrid document where you name somebody as your healthcare representative. And you also give some instructions to them. That has the advantage of both making your wishes known and also from an emotional standpoint, making things a little bit easier for the person that you're naming. If push comes to shove and they have to make a significant life or death type decision, from an emotional standpoint, it's not going to be easy. But it is emotionally easier to follow the directives of the loved one than it is to try to guess what the loved one would have wanted done and then, act based upon that. So, we certainly recommend that type of form be done. Now, I'd like to mention one other type of document, which most people have not heard of, despite the fact that it was passed into law in December of 2011. It's a little known, document in the state of New Jersey, and it's called a POLST form. That's P-O-L-S-T, and it stands for Practitioner Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. And it is a healthcare planning tool that empowers individuals to work closely with the medical team to detail the goals and the medical preferences when facing a serious illness. Unlike other documents like an advanced directive, a completed POLST form is an actual medical order that becomes a part of the individual's medical record. It's valid in all healthcare settings. And I think one of the possible reasons why it hasn't reached great popularity is that in order to complete it, it must be completed by a physician or an advanced practice nurse who would go over the POLST form itself, would assist the person in making some decisions with regard to a number of areas, including the extent of medical intervention, the extent of artificially administered fluids and nutrition, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, airway management, and the like. So it requires that that team effort, and I think possibly one of the reasons that there has not been increased use of it is the fact that a lot of times I think the medical professionals with total good faith are looking to do everything that is necessary to give the person every shot at making it, and sometimes I think limiting the extent to which care is provided is kind of viewed as defeat or something like that. So overall, in looking at the planning process, it's very important to get the protection of doing the planning, to choose who is to be providing the assistance, and to recognize that you have the ability to specify the terms of the existence. In the absence of planning, sometimes you'll see people doing makeshift arrangements where, Aunt Mary has, her niece, prepare, various documents for her, do her checks, et cetera, and then she just signs it. That unfortunately creates a risk of abuse of this confidential, relationship. As I talked about, earlier in the show, sometimes the lack of planning results in a need for a guardianship rather than a power of attorney. The cost difference of the two is drastic. The cost of a properly done power of attorney, you might be talking about something in the neighborhood of $150. The cost of a guardianship in New Jersey, you're probably talking about something in the neighborhood of $4,000 to $5,000. Before we continue in this category, I'd just like to remind our listeners, first of all, that the phone lines are still open, 732-281-5970 and 5971. I'd like to also remind our listeners that if anyone out there is a member of a civic group or organization and is interested in having someone come to speak to their group, please contact our office. You can call at 732-657-0600, or you can reach us at www.novylaw, that's NOVYLAW.com. Our Ocean County office is at 2915 Ridgeway Road in Manchester, New Jersey. And our Monmouth office, which is on an appointment-only basis, is at the Brook 35 Plaza in Seagirt, New Jersey. If you have any, you know, questions or topics that you wish to have presented or answered on the show, please contact us. And, you know, if we answer your question on the show or cover the topic, you'll be receiving a $50 gift certificate to a local restaurant. You know, we try to, you know, present information at various, you know, places. I know coming up April 23rd, I believe, there is a lunch and learn at the Lakehurst Naval Base. And Bob Novy will be speaking there. Now, I talked at the beginning of the show about the fact that sometimes this issue is not so much for ourselves, but it's dealing dealing with others. And you know, our caller from Jackson was talking about that area. You know, there are certain symptoms that can signal impending dementia, and dementia is one of the very common reasons for diminished capacity, and that, you know, the those symptoms can mean that it's time for family members to take some steps to prepare. You can have a situation where a person may live thousands of miles away from his loved one, mom, dad, or whoever, but nevertheless, you know, he knows something is wrong. You know, she's repeating herself, asking a question or telling a story two or three times in the same conversation. She used to be decisive. Now she hems and haws about everything, including, you know, where the family will celebrate the holidays or when she's going to go visit someone. Maybe having minor traffic accidents, a sign that depth perception may be faulty, which can be another potential sign of dementia, and if asked about these things, she can become very defensive when people express concerns, and, you know, dad may blow the rest of the family off, suggesting that you know, that there is a problem, and he says, you know, everything is fine. And it's all pretty common when families are dealing with the early stages of any illness, but particularly when it's, you know, dementia. You know, people don't want to admit that they can't live independently anymore, and denial is very common, not only for the individual involved, but also for the family members, because acknowledging that there's a problem can be painful and frightening. But as I had indicated earlier, denial can be a huge problem and a huge cost. You know, even if a person does have Alzheimer's or some other form of dementia, you know, early detection permits treatment with medications that may allow the person to live independently for a longer period, or some, you know, causes of dementia are treatable. You know, delay can prevent the person from making wishes known about future treatment plans, which then, as I indicated, you know, puts an added burden on the family, and it can rob the person of the opportunity to make important financial and legal plans, which would protect assets and designate people to make decisions when he or she no longer can. You know, speaking about money, people with dementia and other forms of diminished capacity are more vulnerable to scams. They also have, you know, potential poor judgment that can leave them financially devastated. Unfortunately, I've seen instances where a person gets so involved in charitable giving that they give to the point of rendering themselves, you know, destitute. Now, making a bad financial decision isn't always a sign of dementia. I've seen reports that tend to suggest that, you know, our financial abilities, you know, peak in our late 40s or 50s, and then slide gradually downhill from there. And in all of these things about dementia or lack of capacity, it's a matter of degree. The occasional financial mistake may not indicate a problem, but messing up repeatedly or in big ways, you know, can be an indication that a problem does exist and something needs to be done. I know I've had, you know, numerous discussions with, geriatric professionals about, you know, these situations and telltale signs. You know, they'll indicate things that, like, forgetting a word now and again is a normal part of aging. But what's not is having made up names such as you know, calling a watch a hand clock or something like that, or having difficulty in carrying on a conversation. You know, sometimes people who were ordinarily rather talkative become very quiet, and that is their way of avoiding conversation to disguise their inability to keep up with it. If people are getting confused about what day of the week it is, that could be a sign of normal aging if the person later figures it out. But if they're constantly misplacing things and are unable to retrace their steps to find it, or you know, frequently not being able to recognize the day of the week or the season or something like that, then that could certainly be a problem. Also, becoming set in our ways can be a typical part of aging, and we may get irritated if our routines are disrupted, but big personality or mood changes usually aren't normal, and if someone is becoming extremely anxious, easily upset, defensive or suspicious when they didn't used to be, you know, dementia, you know, could be the cause. You know, one discussion that I've had with some people is, you know, talking about the level of intelligence. Sometimes the people will say, well, you know, I'm not crazy or I'm not stupid or something like that, and that, you know, is probably you know, certainly the case. They are not crazy or stupid, but they may be experiencing diminished capacity, and this may be a sign, you know, that they need to have some help with the, you know, various estate planning documents that I talked about, and lining up, you know, medical, you know, practitioners. You know, one factor to consider is that if a person has a relatively, you know, high level of intelligence and a high fund of knowledge, that may enable them to deal with their diminishing capacity for a longer period of time. And then, unfortunately, you know, sometimes those people, instead of evidencing a gradual decline in capacity, will have a very severe and abrupt drop-off. So, you know, if you see some of these symptoms in either yourself or in family members, I encourage you to take some appropriate action, you know, to deal with the situation and to, you know, protect against big problems down the road. One issue that frequently comes up in these situations is, you know, how old is too old to drive? That's not meant to be a trick question, but there is no bright line between those who should and shouldn't be driving. Age alone does not determine whether an individual should be driving, whether we're talking about someone who's 20 or 80. But if there are indications that the person is getting lost or is having you know, repeated you know, fender benders, things of that nature, then unfortunately it's very often a situation where the family has to for both the protection of their loved one and for other people out there, kind of step in and take action to address that. I'd just like to quickly give a website address if people are interested in additional information on this. This is from the National Institute of Health, and it is the website is nihseniorhealth.gov/olderdrivers/how-aging-affects-driving. So that's nihseniorhealth.gov/olderdrivers/how-aging-affects-driving. And there is a lot of information in there about changing skill levels, information on alternatives to getting around and things of that nature. I'd like to end by indicating that you're not alone out there. There are professionals who can assist, including elder law attorneys, financial planners, care managers, geriatric physicians, and the like, and support groups. I'd like to thank everyone here at WOBM-AM and you, our callers and listening audience, for your interest in the show. I'd like to remind you that our office is a member of the Senior Resource Alliance, which is a group of companies designed to help those who are in the elder care area. If you have any questions, please call us at 732-657-0600. Hope we've given you some information that's of assistance and that you have a great weekend. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.